quantum theory and four concepts, wave particle duality, superposition, gender and randomness, and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And we started going through the double slit experiment. Very simple experiment where you just have a wall with two holes in it, and you fire, it could be a water wave, number of tennis balls or other particles, or it could be electrons, in one case, at the wall. And then you see what sort of pattern or what sort of distribution of splotches or intensity or energy with the water waves, for example, in that example, you see at the other side, at the final wall. And that gives you some idea, it's an indirect indication, but many, most experiments in physics are indirect, give you an indirect indication of just what sort of things or entities or animals you have. So we looked at, we got on to looking at the double slit experiment with electrons. And remember, it's something they did in Japan in the 1980s. And what they had is basically call it an electron gun. It's just some very, very hot piece of metal that, in a sense, heats up electrons so that they ionize. I don't think that's... Oh. Sorry. I think it's... The IT people don't like that. Sorry, Chris. Okay, it's off now. So they did actually the double slit experiment, and essentially so they had thousands of electrons, and again they did the experiment where the electrons are actually going one by one towards the first wall, wall A here. And then somehow they got through the slits, and they're in the middle here. And when quantum physics, just as a water wave is spread out entity, every single point in space around here, you can associate an amplitude of that, which gives you the height of the wave above the mean position. So in a sense, this is kind of like a probability wave, or a similar thing, an analogous thing for electrons. And not just electrons, but protons and neutrons, and basically everything in quantum physics, this kind of wave. And the pattern of that wave along this wall here is what gives you the probability pattern of finding particles. Because again, it's a statistical thing. Quantum physics, you might find 100 particles there, 2 here, 10 here, whatever the situation is. So a statistical thing, and you build up this pattern here. If you look at it qualitatively, it's exactly the same as double slit interference pattern with light. So it's exactly the same in the qualitative features. So this is what we saw yesterday. And we saw the strange thing is that the kind of naive particle model that a lot of students have of an electron is a tiny, solid, hard sphere, scaled down marble or tennis ball, just it doesn't work. You can have experiments where you have one slit open, one way for the particles to get through. You can find at a certain point, I don't know, I just pick these numbers up the top of my head, for hypothetical case, find 100 or 200 electrons hitting the wall at one particular point. I think 400 was the example I used. And then you open up another slit. And so you let even, you have to give another wave, second wave for the electrons, double the waves that the electrons can get through. And you actually end up getting less electrons coming through at that particular point. And it's both mysterious and profound. If you have, again, if you have these blinkers on, you think electrons, particles, and it's just very, very, very strange thing. Because you're doubling the avenues, but getting electrons there, less electrons there. But from a wave point of view, then it's just destructive interference. You get the two possibilities happening. And just as you get a crest and a trough, they're destructively interfering with each other. And that's why you get the lower number. And that's why, for example, you can have these situations. Here we have the probability of finding electrons at one particular point or one particular region when both slits are open can be actually less than the sum of the two probabilities when the individual slits are open. Okay. And we saw if we wanted to get a little bit technical, just as we might have a double slit experiment with waves, and we have one amplitude from the wave going through one slit, and another amplitude from the wave going through the other slit, what we do is we just sort of, in a sense, superpose the two amplitudes on top of each other, and define the amplitude, total amplitude, at one point. We just add the amplitudes together, and remember the amplitudes could be negative, so it could be adding a positive and negative. In case of destructive interference, when they're out of phase by pi, for example, and then to find the intensity, we get total amplitude, and we square that, and it's very, very analogous thing here. So basically, if you want to highlight one equation, this is really the essential equation here. adding the two probability amplitudes in this case, and then squaring the sum. And we saw an example there. Just putting, yes?
Sorry, what did you mean by normalized in the last slide?
Oh, yeah, that's just a really technical thing. But basically, you want the probability of, if you have one electron, you want the probability of finding it somewhere to be one. If you add up all the probabilities, that's all I mean. So, we put some numbers in here, 1/5 minus 1/4 for the amplitude of going through slit 1 and slit 2. And sort of a more abstract point, but it's in particular example of general rule in quantum theory, that if you have two ways something can happen, you could detect a particle, and there's just no way in principle you could tell between them, then you actually add the amplitudes and then take the square of the sum. So that's sort of a more general technical point. So, okay. So, do you have your whiteboards or?
No.
No, okay, great. I will. Sorry, another thing I forgot, Dave. Yes. Thanks. Okay, so time for an activity. And so a very, very similar thing. So again, the double slit experiment, and what I'll do is. Yes.
Would protons and neutrons exhibit an interference pattern as well?
Absolutely, and I've actually seen neutron interference. The thing is, so your proton neutron, it's 1,000 times or 500 times more massive, so the de Broglie wavelength is smaller by that factor. So it's harder to see, but they have actually seen neutron interference with neutrons. Protons, I don't know.
So they predict the same thing with antiparticles, like antiprotons?
Yes. The only thing is you need, they're very hard to create.
Right. You would then predict to see the same thing as
Absolutely. So the de Broglie wavelength depends on the mass, and antimatter does have positive mass. So, absolutely. So, so again, a view from above, and I just picked some particular point. Okay, everyone's got their whiteboards, so I just picked some particular point on wall B, that's just Y, and we've got the x-axis here. Pick some particular point, and assuming slit 1 is open, although the amplitude for the wave to go through slit 1 is plus 1 over 10, and to go through slit 2, so that's 2 there, is plus 1 over 5 fifth. And so three questions for you. What is the probability? It's given by that expression there, the square of the modulus of psi, of detecting the electron of Y when just one slit is open. And the mathematical expression there. And that's slit 1. And if we close slit 1 and open slit 2, what's the probability? And what is the probability when both slits are open for finding a particle in the region Y here? And then compare the two. Do we find, as we found before, that this probability is less than those two probabilities? So again, we're doing an example. We're actually going through the numbers, doing some real serious quantum physics, actually finding out how we calculate. This is how professional physicists calculate probabilities in quantum physics, using this probability amplitude or this wave function, if you like. So I should say this is a team activity. No need to hide your answers from the person, people next to you. So collaborate, do groups, check them. Okay, so I'll give you about 3 minutes. Oh, the line is Okay. So all the I'll give them that when I come back. Okay, and that's fine. And then make a see Roberta or Dave, and then pass it on from the pizza. I'm giving you the ask the one from the second last question of the same. Let's get the link from the see Roberta. Looks like everyone's done. So, just a very, very brief interlude. So tomorrow we have the second keynote presentation, and that's 10:30 a.m. to 12 noon, and that's Simone Speziali. We'll be talking about loop quantum gravity, and we have an introductory article on loop quantum gravity from Scientific American. From 2004, and it's about 10 pages. So if you could, tonight, if you could have a look at that. If you spend a little bit of time reading that, then you'll probably get, I would say, 2-3 times more out of the lecture tomorrow. We'll just introduce you to some of the terms and some of the basic concepts we'll be talking about. So it's interesting enough, if you look at the author for that, that's actually Lee Smolin, who was one of the founders of discoverers of quantum gravity in the late 80s. And he's actually one of the faculty here at Derivative Institute. So he's unfortunately, he couldn't get a minute to talk this week, but he was actually one of our founding members here at Derivative Institute. You may well see him wandering around. Or I guess, what does he look like, Roberta?
Oh, he's got the hair and this intense look in his eyes. And he's very nice man. A fascinating speaker, and he's my hero.
Right, okay.
Yay. He's the Woody Allen of theoretical.
Right, yeah. Okay. So I'm sure from that description you'll be able to see him, spot him.
So he needs 40 people spare him.
Yeah, okay. And also we have another article. So we have tomorrow a session on physics education research that touches on that. And here we have an article about different ways and really what some very, very recent research has said about methods and ways and approaches to teach physics. And that's by Carl Wieman, who some of you may have heard, actually won the Nobel Prize in Physics for Bose-Einstein condensate sometime in the mid-90s, I think. And just very recently, a couple of months ago, people from BC will notice he actually moved from, I think it was MIT or University of Colorado, somewhere there, to come here to Canada, to University of British Columbia, because his big thing, he's gone away from research, and he's into teaching. So he's gone on a crusade, if you like, to change and update and modernize the way physics is taught. Because there's a lot of research out there, which very few people are aware of, essentially espousing the benefits, you know, the large benefits of more particular types of interactive teaching and active teaching. So he's very, very big on that and talking a lot about that. Okay, we have a first question, probability when the first slit is open. So if everyone could hold up their whiteboards. Great. Okay, so I can gain. I have to look around a bit, but I get a snapshot to make sure people in the back row are slacking off. What did they? Oh, wow. They just. Okay, great.
Show your work.
Yeah, half marks off the one. Isn't that the rule? So fantastic. So I think everyone had it right, so great. Everyone's getting this. So what we have, this is greater than the sum of those two. So that's an example of constructive interference. Yes?
On that one, since the probability for slit 2 was a higher probability, mean like your diagram would be more likely that the y would be closer to the 2?
Yeah, good point. Yep. Good point. So, yeah.
And is like the ratio of the two of them to kind of tell you where y is? Like, is it about twice as close to that one? As
roughly, but that would be the assumption the probability drops off linearly, which it does, and it's some kind of complicated curve. But if you wanted to get a crude estimate, then yeah. Good thought, though. So we've looked at interference we get with electrons, but as I said before, it's not something unique and special to electrons, and they're just examples of standard behavior that you get all quantum entities. And because we think quantum physics, as far as we know, it's universal, applies even up to the macroscopic scale, but just at the macroscopic scale, it just coincides with Newtonian physics. All the weird features get kind of lost, if you like. But in theory, a car or a tank or a baseball has a wave-like aspect to it. They have a de Broglie wave. You can calculate it. So in theory, you could do the double slit experiment with anything you like. But of course, as the object gets more massive, the wavelength just gets phenomenally tiny, and the experiments just get technically impossible to do. But having said that, scientists have actually done experiments, interference experiments, with larger objects, and diffraction experiments, and 2001, some scientists in Vienna in Austria, they actually observed diffraction with fullerene molecules or buckyballs. And they are molecules. We had 60 carbon atoms arranged in a solvable light configuration. That's a little snapshot of it there. And essentially, they did the single slit experiment, saw the actual diffraction pattern spreading out the little fringes here. And they had a slit width of around about 50 nanometers, so very, very small. The de Broglie wavelength of the buckyball was, again, very small, of the order of picometers, so order of 10 to the minus 12. And if you calculate the mass, 60 carbon atoms, and each one of those has carbon 12, we assume, 6 protons, 6 neutrons, and so the mass is over a million times more than an electron. So it's mass, and the velocity they had ran about 210 centimeters. Essentially, they had some sort of an oven here that actually produced or shot out these buckyballs. They came, and a collimator just to get them going in the right direction. Then they actually came towards here and then, spread out, diffracted, and they actually saw the diffraction pattern. They saw kind of the fringes, diffraction maximum and minimum. And if you want to have a sort of brief look at the experiment, I remember actually visiting them in doing my PhD in, early 2000, and it was just amazing. See the experiment. So one interesting thing, that's actually a photo of the real experiment there. It's interesting to kind of compare the real experiment, which took them, I think, about 3 months to build and another 3 months to actually get right. It's a phenomenally, phenomenally complicated experiment. So that's the experimentalist view of the experiment. We're, of course, Institute for Theoretical Physics, so our view of the experiment is the somewhat simplified version here. Yes?
How do you detect buckyballs?
How do you detect buckyballs?
Besides the detector. Just tell me what the detector is.
I'm just trying to think. I don't know if I can remember, actually, but... I can't actually remember how you could... I'm not sure. So a lot of these things are actually what they call sort of scintillation counters or multiplied counters that you get. One way of doing it in principle, you could get just a couple of other atoms and you could get or charged particles. And you get the buckyballs to collide with the charged particles like electrons and they scatter those. And then you have some sort of voltage difference and they attract the electrons. And then you get two or three electrons scattered and then they are attracted to some plate by a potential. And then those electrons are accelerated by the potential, and they hit and they scatter off, say, 4 electrons. And then those other electrons are scattered by another potential. So it's a multiplier, like a photomultiplier type thing. I suspect that's essentially how all of these things work. So they have a source there, which is basically an oven producing these buckyballs, and then the collimator just to get them going in straight line, diffraction with the slits. And then some sort of detector. So very, very impressive experiment. There's the wavelength for more information. We've got there in your notes. And if you look at the world, yes, Sean.
I was going to ask, where is kind of like the meeting point between macroscopic and
quantum? So where's kind of the line? Yeah. Actually, that's an excellent question. That would be an excellent question to ask Hans Westman on Friday. A lot of people have thought a lot about this, and you think, well, it'd be nice if there was a one line, like if anything's less than a micrometer in size, or anything's less than a billionth of a gram. It's kind of weird. Two things. First of all, it seems as if there's no sharp line, and it depends on the particular experiment. That you can actually get quantum behavior. I mean, you can get quantum superposition. They've seen that with billions in examples. Well, actually, they've seen quantum superposition in clouds of cesium atoms when you have something like 10 to the power 13 of them. Now, that's probably the most macroscopic example I can think of. So that's a very large number. But then you can experiments where you could have 10 cesium atoms and they behave classically. The quantumness gets sort of knocked out just because of the circumstance of the experiment. So it's really a case-by-case basis. And often depends on the temperature. Generally, the cooler the temperature it is, the less kind of disruptive effects you have. So the more spooky a quantum strange effects you can have. So it does depend a lot. And also, it's not you get to one line and you suddenly jump over to class. It's more, you know, it's a continuous thing. But that's very subtle. It's a case by case. Yes.
And there's the one bigger that Tony Leggett was talking about.
Oh.
You can see superfluous with quantum behavior. You can
see that's true.
It's method. Well, it's math.
Yeah, yes.
It's quantum behavior. But it's not inferred specifically like this.
No. But it's definitely this quantum there. So, yep. That's a good point. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
It's fun with kids to figure out, okay, what further wavelength would you need to diffract as you left the classroom?
Right, yeah.
Opening of the door and stuff. And so you have H over momentum.
Yep.
For the divergent wavelength. And what's weird about that is when you have mass times volume in the denominator,
yep.
The slower you go, the bigger your divergent wavelength.
Yes.
Maybe that's counterintuitive.
Right.
It's weird to tell you, if you just walk really slowly through the door, there'll be an area you can't walk to. I would like some guidance from the physics superstars in this room, anyone, in terms of how do you kind of, to me it would be the faster you go, the more quantum you are. A lot flies in the face of common sense, but to me, that relationship of slowing down, increasing your divergent wavelength, increasing diffraction seems weird to me.
Right. Okay. So the faster you go, that makes sense. From the faster you go, the faster you go, the more energy you have, the more kinetic energy you have. And so, if you think of things from a frequency point of view, equals HF, then the faster you go, the higher frequency you have. And if you have a higher frequency, then you've got to have a.
Then you're more particle.
Sorry? Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. Roberta.
How about the faster you go, more kinetic energy? More energy is like more mass.
Mm-hmm.
And more mass is more like a particle, isn't it?
You can think of, think of that way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a good way. So maybe that's a discussion for a break. But yeah, it is counterintuitive. So, yeah, but I don't have to think about that one. But, yeah.
Like, literally, the answer for the kids is they have to walk extremely times 10 to the minus something.
Right,
slowly through the door for them to diffract.
Right, yeah.
And it's a boring experiment, but... I don't know, it just doesn't seem right to me that the way to get them to behave in a way is to go incredibly slow.
Right. Yeah.
Without some kind of way to. I just need some kind of hook to kind of.
Yeah.
Or maybe, that's not the best way to think about it. For
so the, the frequency way works. If you're the higher the energy, faster you go, the higher, the more the kinetic energy. And the more the kinetic energy, if you have a photon that has more kinetic energy, then that has a higher frequency by E equals HF, but it has a higher frequency then by the wave equation, C equals F lambda, necessarily has a smaller wavelength. So if the photons, the smaller, the shorter wavelengths are associated with higher energy.
That's a good way to end it.
Yeah, but that's actually a good question.
Conceptually.
Yeah, because you think, fast is this quantum thing. Yeah, but another way of thinking about it, generally when you have, so this is a very, very crude hand wavy. Generally the quantum things are easy to see when things are colder, when you actually, say, for example, see the Bose-Einstein condensates, there's some weird effects that Carl Wieman won his Nobel Prize for, and their effects where you get whole bunch of atoms, and you actually get cooled down to just above absolute zero, and you actually get them overlapping with each other, so they're in exactly the same, basically the same quantum state as each other. To see those, you need things very, very cold, and very, very cold actually is associated with sort of very slow, exactly. And so that is a lot of experiments where things are very, very cold, you see the quantum effects more. So maybe that's another way of looking at it, but it's a good question. So the world record for wave behavior of massive particles is the end of 2003, same group of scientists, and they actually saw it in fluorinated fullerene, that's the molecule there, and that's more, just about 1.5 million times more massive than an electron. And the same scientists, what they're trying to do now is observe the wave nature of viruses, things that are about a tenth of a micrometer, 10 to the minus 7 meters, and in some sense are alive, the most basic alive things that we know of. And are there any fundamental limits? You touched on that. And no. So in principle, we can see it as wave behavior of a student diffracting through a door. In principle, of course, so if you actually figure out the calculation, the debris wavelength, I'm not sure how small it would be, but it would be just minuscule. And for more information, there's the wavelength there. So we kind of looked at the double-slit experiment and wave-like nature of quantum particles and what you actually see in quantum physics with electrons, and also touched on other particles. Now, what can we kind of distill out of that? If you had to get four phrases for quantum physics that you wanted to put on a t-shirt to wear every day as you're teaching a student, what four phrases would you put on that? Well, here's one answer. So the one is definitely the wave-particle duality is a key core concept. So we're looking at this, and that is that we saw that the electrons, we saw in the movie that moved from Japan, there were all these dots, more and more dots coming on the screen. So the electrons hit as localized dots, as particles, always somewhere here or there, not everywhere spread out. Only one electron hits in one single place. So that's a particle-like aspect to electrons. But we saw electrons give the double slit interference pattern. So that's a wave-like aspect on the other hand. And so what electrons are, in a sense, they're schizophrenic. They've got a bit of particle in them. They've got a bit of wave in them. And so, but really, I think the answer to this, so are electrons particles or waves or are they? Some people say they're both. I would actually say they're neither. Because an electron or a particle is something that always acts like a particle. All the time, 100% of the time, 24/7, it acts like a particle. A wave is something that always acts like a wave in every single experiment, all the times. And so electrons, what they do is they sometimes act like particles and sometimes act like waves. So they're actually neither. And Richard Feynman, a very famous physicist, won a Nobel Prize in 1965 for quantum physics, said historically the electron, for example, was thought to behave like a particle. And then it was found that in many respects it behaved like a wave. So really it behaves like neither. So now we've given up. Now we say it's like neither. So because it doesn't either behave all the time like a particle or a wave, it's neither. And so maybe we should think up some special term. We call them wavicles. Or just electrons are electrons and they do what they do. And because of this, you really don't want to take too literally the ideas of electrons really being a wave in some experiments and really being a particle. They're very useful to get pictures of, but I think you really want to keep in the back of your mind that these are just models that we're actually using. And really, when you get down to it, you know, when you get a physicist drunk and you say, look, you know, what really are electrons and stuff at 3 o'clock in the morning? In some sense, they're just electrons, and we fundamentally don't know what they do. But we have these models, and sometimes this intuitive wave model is a very good way of thinking about things. Sometimes the intuitive particle model is. And so there's this dual or twin nature. So, and it's not just for electrons, you see the same thing. Photons, you can do essentially, I mean, a double slit experiment with photons and see the same thing. And with neutrons, I've seen particle and wave-like nature of neutrons, buckyballs, all particles, runs all throughout quantum physics. And so what that tells us is, in general, neither the traditional pictures of waves and particles are by themselves sufficient at the quantum level. But if we actually, we can only use each of them in certain experiments for certain situations that we're looking at. But if we kind of, in a sense, patch them together or put them together like two pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, that they are actually complete. And at least for electrons, any situation you look at it will either manifest a particle-like nature or it will manifest a wave-like nature. So whatever experiment you're talking about, one of those two pictures will actually suffice, will actually be useful, whether you're looking at the Compton scattering, in that case it's a particle-like picture, or the interference pattern, in which case it's a wave-like. model. So it's very much a piecemeal solution. But really, one thing is that telling us is just we have these categories of particles and waves. These are things that people have been thinking about since the times of ancient Greece. These are models that scientists have built up, like Isaac Newton, for example, by looking at things at the everyday scale, sort of ripples in a pond, apples falling from trees, and these are macroscopic, everyday, common sense things. And why should these models apply at the everyday level? Why should they work at the level of an atom, which is 10 billion times smaller than a meter? Why should, and there's no reason why down at this really, really tiny level, things should not be completely different. And they are. So, get on to the second core feature of quantum physics, and that is superposition. And so superposition is not something that you only find in quantum physics. You can get water waves, and you can get through the double-slit experiment with water waves. And you can actually get the same thing. You can get a wave going through one slit, through the other slit, and then they kind of combine, overlap, and you get the superposition of the two world water waves. But even though you can find it in sort of ordinary water waves, acoustic waves, it is actually something that's the key core part just running all throughout quantum physics. And the double slit experiment, we saw that it had actually been done with one single electron. And only one electron passing through all wall A at any one time. And scientists still saw, after thousands of electrons being detected, the interference pattern. And what this suggests, perhaps, although this is not completely uncontroversial, is that each individual electron is going through both slits at the same time, and then it's interfering with themselves. If you get this interference pattern built up, and you only ever have one slit going through your apparatus through the experiment at one time, how else, unless you have interference going on at the individual electron level, how else are you actually going to explain the overall pattern that you see? And so it's kind of a schematic there. So what we find is that the everyday level, again, baseballs, cars, trees, are constrained to only exist in one place at one time. That's something we see every day of our life. Our individual quantum entities, such as electrons, atoms, and protons, can exist in so-called fuzzy states of affairs, or blurred states of affairs, if you like, called superposition states, in which it seems that multiple possibilities can be simultaneously realized. And one example of that is, if we look at the quantum state, if we want to write down this sort of probability wave or probability amplitude wave for the electron, it's made up of two bits, this bit and this bit, corresponding to the electron going through this slit and the electron going through that slit at the same time. And again, there are sort of some technical details that people debate about, but Hans Westman on Friday will be talking more about that. So, and one interesting thing, you're going to the Institute for Quantum Computing today at in the afternoon, and so this is actually related to quantum computing. And so if you look at a computer you have today, computers you have on your desk, this computer here, pretty much they're just, if they want to do a complex computation, a calculation, they can only do one calculation at once. They have to calculate one thing, and then another thing, and another thing. But quantum computers, just as an electron can go through two slits at the same time, so they're not constrained just to do one computation at one time. They could do one, and another one, and another one, and another one. And you can get up in principle to any number you like, thousands or millions of computations at once. And so that this, in a sense, is inbuilt multitasking, or this inbuilt parallelism, that just as, again, you can get the electron going through both slits at once, the quantum entity can do two things at once, or three things at once. So these quantum computers can do many, many, many things at once. And so perhaps you could see how it could be very, very powerful for you or a computer to be able just to do this amazing amount of multitasking. And that is a key feature. It's not the whole story, but it's a key feature behind why quantum computers, in theory, are much, much, much more powerful for solving certain problems than the computers we use today, even the most powerful supercomputers. Now, in terms of, so the idea of quantum computers has been around since 1983. But, and so on paper, they work perfectly. They're fine, you know, theoretically. But in terms of the experimentally, they're just very, very, very hard to build. Because if you have a computer, the individual parts or components of it are made up of a single atom. You're working at the level of a single atom. What you have to do is you have to have precise control over components and the bits at the level of a single atom. And that's just very, very, very difficult to do. If you think about, a grain of sand, again, that's the smallest thing I can imagine. If you think about trying to precisely control that and, for example, move it exactly 1 centimeter to the right or exactly flip it over and turn it 180 degrees. So that would be challenging even if you had a magnifying glass and a pair of tweezers for a person to do. And so just as in that sense, that small, small object is very, very tough to control. If you imagine trying to get that level of control, but with something a million times smaller than a grain of sand. So if you imagine how difficult that would be, that gives you an idea of one of the reasons why quantum computers are just so tough to actually build in practice. So theoreticians can be a bit harsh, and we like to joke that, well, we've figured it all out, we've done the theory for it, it's just the experimentalists slack, because they haven't actually built them yet. But please don't tell anyone that. We can edit that out from the tape. But they're working incredibly hard. It's amazing, the actual experiments that they have done. And you'll get to see some of those. Okay, so that's a little aside advert for quantum computing. And superposition, again, not just with electrons, it's photons, protons, neutrons, all quantum particles. And it's perhaps the defining feature of quantum physics. And underlies the counterintuitive phenomena of the electrons seeming to go through both slits at the same time. And it's not just that, it's something I'll talk a little bit later on, is entanglement. And what entanglement is they talked a bit about that with the Aspect experiments. And they actually got experiment, he talked about one over 10 kilometers, and this was something done in Switzerland. They actually got two photons, and you'll see, and they actually got a laser beam, and they shot it to a particular type of birefringent crystal like calcite. So just get a laser beam, like a laser pointer here, shine it to one of these crystals, calcite, another birefringent crystal, and then there's a very small chance that that crystal will absorb the photons in the laser beam. And when it does, if it absorbs one of them, then one of them actually, that excites an electron in the crystal. And that electron, eventually, after a little while of being excited, eventually decays and goes back down to the lower energy electronic state it was in before. And when it doesn't do that in one jump by emitting one photon. It actually does it in two jumps by going down and emitting. So that's just the electron energy levels there, excited state, intermediate state, ground state, and just the electron jumping down, giving off a photon, then jumping down again, giving up another photon. And these photons are actually, what they did was they got one of the photons, put it in a fiber optic cable, and sent it. Send it to one village 5 kilometers away, and that's my diagram of the Swiss village, by the way. So I'm going to art school at the moment. And so that's another one, and so the distance between these, I think it was around about 10 or 11 kilometers, so it was approximately 10 kilometers. And then they actually detected the photons here and the photons there. And just looking at the results, when they actually compared the results later on, so they do this not just with two photons, but you actually repeat the experiment many times, and you build up the statistics, and they actually looked at those statistics. What they actually saw, what seemed to be happening, is that the photons, by some special weird spooky, the word spooky is in the title. By some sort of spooky means they're actually instantaneously communicating with each other in some way that we fundamentally don't understand. But that exactly what allows them to do that, or the technical term for that, this sort of, in the sense, instantaneous communication faster than the speed of light, is entanglement. And they actually have that at the Institute for Quantum Computing. You'll see an example of that this afternoon. But underlying that is superposition. So it's really everywhere. You get also generally in quantum interference, and also in quantum tunneling. And I'll say also it is found you can get superposition with water waves, electromagnetic waves, sound waves. So it's not unique to quantum theory, but it's still, that still doesn't mean that just because you can get it elsewhere, that it's not still a core part of quantum theory. There are some analogies between superposition with waves and superposition you get in quantum physics, but also some disanalogies, because if you could do everything that you could do in quantum physics with superposition, if you could do it with just water waves, then you know quantum physics would not be so weird and so strange and so spooky. So, okay. So just to mention some differences, we talked about this before, that if you do the double slit experiment with waves, the wave spreads out, and you actually measure the energy gets distributed over a wide, wide region. So the wave spreads out, and if you had a row of buoys at the final wall, the detection wall, a large number of them would sort of bob up and down. The energy is spread out. But we saw what happens with the electron experiment. What happens as soon as you measure it, the energy gets localized. So in some senses, when you measure the wave, it kind of collapses down into this small point, and the energy is localized. And you don't get that with water waves. So that's one disanalogy. And the example, and this is a quote I get from one of my favorite books, what's paraphrased, and that is Quantum: A Guide for the Perplexed. So it's as if electrons and other quantum entities are acting like waves when we're not looking at them, but particles when we are. That's one rough way of looking at it. And I talked about this sort of, if you want to get technical and impress your students, this kind of collapse or localization is called the collapse of the wave function. There's just one technical point there, but I won't go over that. Yes?
What if the students can do the traditional experiment, something like annihilation of the electrons, so they use two photons?
What do they measure?
Why wouldn't they do space like this?
Why would they?
What's so special about this particular experiment?
It was over the greatest distance. So experiments like this had been done before, but this was really the first one that was done over a substantial distance where they actually had a physical difference between two. So there's, I mean, this is like the Aztec experiment from the 1980s, but just expanded up. So, yeah.
I'm wondering, you said that they communicated.
Right.
What would qualitatively be some of the indicators of communication?
Sorry?
What would be some of the indicators of the communication?
Right. The correlations between them, or the connections or the links between them, that if you actually do this experiment, repeat it 1,000 times, then you get 1,000 measurement results here and 1,000 measurement results here. And if you actually just bring them together and sort of look at them and compare the two, you find really intimate, tight, strong connections. And for example, if they're looking at polarization. If they measured a horizontal polarization there, they might have always found a horizontal polarization there. If they measured a vertical polarization there, they might have always found vertical polarization at the other side. If you have really strong connections like that, in a sense, both of the photons are telling a consistent story. They're telling the same story. Then, I mean, how else could you explain why they're so strongly connected to each other if they weren't talking to each other instantaneously?
But the source of the two photons are from the same electron.
Yes, that's right.
So wouldn't that be sufficient reason for the connection?
That's interesting. So that's what Einstein thought. And that's the natural thing, and that's the common sense thing, that, well, the photons were together way back here, so they talked to each other and they got a plan that, they actually sent out. So in that case, I said, if one's horizontal, the other one's always horizontally polarized. And if the one's vertical, the other's vertical. So you might think, well, you just send out the photons and they're always horizontal and horizontal, or vertical and vertical. And so if you actually do that, then that can actually produce obviously some correlations between the two, but then you actually find, if you do a little bit of mathematics, it's actually not that much. You can actually find that the correlations or the links or how strongly the two photons can be connected to each other, they can be by a certain amount, but not actually too much. There's actually a kind of an upper limit just to how tightly they're connected to each other, because obviously the photons can't talk to each other while they're being measured. And the thing is, they don't know what measurements will be made here. And then if you actually go and look at the experiment, that hypothesis, so that's an hypothesis you can have, and that will have a limit to the correlations. And if you actually go out and do the experiment, then you find the connections between the two photons actually beat that limit. They're actually more strongly connected, and the correlations are actually tighter than you would expect. And so you can imagine one way, if you wanted to actually get really, really strong type correlations here, if you imagine if the photons, if you had sort of walkie-talkies instantaneously from GV, you could do that. What I might do now is actually, I was going to talk about this a little bit later, from around 11:30 to 12. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to defer all the questions now until then. But this is very, very deep, subtle thing. And so we'll look at that a little bit later on. So sorry to cut off discussion. Okay. So this is just really an illustration showing that perhaps the image of physics is a bit different to the actual reality. We've got some work to do. We're trying. Okay, core feature number 3. So, genuine randomness. So imagine doing the double slit experiment with electrons, but let's have a slight variation. Instead of... So what we do is we just have two cameras or two some type of detectors. And what we do is we just put them right there next to slit 2 and next to slit 1. And we place the detectors next to each other. And what we do is we just watch. We want to see. We want to know what's happening to each electron as they actually go past the wall A. So exactly how do they go through? Do they really go through both slits at the same time? And so if we do this, we're keeping the experiment exactly the same. We've just added the two cameras in there. So surely we'll see the trademark clearance pattern. Surely this won't make any difference. So, and strangely enough, the answer is no. They've done experiments like this where they've got detectors. And what you actually find is just the very act, no matter how you actually set up these detectors, seems like the very act of trying to see which slit in each individual electron went through happens to actually necessarily disturb or mess up the interference. And so you don't see the interference pattern, but you actually see the pattern there with just two bumps like that you would get for tennis balls. Yes?
You said they don't absorb the electron, but they certainly interfere with the electron.
Absolutely, yes. Sure, so to detect something, detection is a physical process. So you've got to have an electric field there that somehow moves the electron a little bit. You might have light that scatters off it. For you to detect something, you've got to have some physical interaction that will bump it a bit, or nudge it, or interfere with it. And that is what causes the disruption. So, yep, good point. Thank you for pointing that out. And so they've actually done this, and they've actually thought about, a lot of people have thought, well, can you have some very sophisticated scheme where you just have a very gentle interaction and you don't absorb the electrons, you only look at them just a little bit, but yet you still find out which slit they went through, and you still get the interference pattern. A lot of people have thought about ways of doing that, but it turns out that you can't, and there are very fundamental reasons why you cannot do that. And one way of looking at it, if you could do that, then you would see the particle-like nature, because you would actually see the electron going through one slit or the other slit like a particle. And you would also see the wave-like nature, the interference nature. And one thing in quantum physics, it just seems you can only see one or the other, that the electrons only reveal, say, their particle-like nature or their wave-like nature. You can't get an experiment where you actually see both of those at the same time, so that's forbidden. Yes?
Why is it that once the electron has been detected, it doesn't go back to being a wave? Because the way I have it in my head is that these electrons interact as particles and often travel as waves, but once it's been detected, the electron where it's not absorbed continues to travel on, so it doesn't go back to traveling as a wave.
So it does. So it does, but then it's kind of it's out of sync. It's lost its coherence with the, so it's lost its, well, actually, you actually, when you, so it might go out here as a spread out wave, you might detect it there, and when you detect it there, it localizes
it's
it.
It's gone past them.
So. Yeah, localizes it. So it kind of, this other possibility, this other components then kind of disappears. And then, so there's no extra half for it to interfere with, but absolutely. Yes,
so
Sean.
So if you put another set of slits afterwards, you'd still get the...
Oh, yeah, you could do that, yeah. If you basically did it again and then started the double slit experiment again, you could, so yeah, good point.
So, like, once you observe it, it's when you observe something in a state, it goes into a state, it stays in it, right? Like,
yeah.
It picks that state, it says, okay.
Exactly.
Like, it goes, stays in that state, kind of, like, goes straight.
Yeah, it does, but as Andrea was saying, it actually it does stay in that state, but then it starts spreading out, as if you can think maybe of the detector as being like a source of waves and a point source of a ripple, so it does spread out again, but it stays in that state in the sense that it doesn't, here it's a superposition of going through there and there. And now it's fixed. It's only going through this one, this other possibility, this wave function.
Let's say you could see the electron with your eyes somehow and you were watching it. Mm-hmm. So it would be like, okay, I'm going to show up right here when you look at it. But then if you turn your back and look the other way, it would say, I'm a wave. Like, how does it know? That, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah. So, I mean... So it is very weird. So, in some sense, but... But the thing about it, to actually, if you're looking about seeing the electron, any process to see the electron, you've got to bounce some light off. You've got to physically interact with some real interaction or collision, and that will be a signal to the electron telling you yes, someone is interacting with me, and for what to do.
But aren't there like things interacting with it all the time? Like you have to know the photon is going to your eye, or like you.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So it's. So, I mean, unless you do the experiment in perfect vacuum, there are things interacting with it all the time. So, I mean, it is a little bit subtle, and the point is, it's really the magnitude of the interaction, so that, and how significant they are, that if you have an electron, this tiny, tiny particle, and you have a camera here or some other macroscopic big object, and you just somehow you look at it, you capture it, then you release it again. That's a very, from the point of view of the tiny, tiny electron, that's a very violent event. It involves lots and lots of energy. It disrupts it in a really big way. And that's very, very different to a small one air molecule just bumping into it and glancing off. And so technically, what would happen in the experiments is, so the air molecules bumping off, they would actually degrade the interference pattern slightly by a couple of percent. You never actually ever see it 100%, but just the information you gain or you could gain from those is so small that it's not really negligible. It's just only a very, very minor interaction. Yes?
If we were to go to a macroscopic object, I know the effect is minimal, but it's still there, would we still see the superposition kind of go away? Like, if, you know, if we're talking about people walking through slits.
Right.
You still notice the same chamber that go away?
So it's kind of like what we were talking about before with the students diffracting through the door. So that in theory, you can do the quantum mechanics for people or anything, and you would get it. So it still would be there in theory, but to actually do it, the wavelengths of everyday objects at room temperature are just, they're tiny, tiny. So in practice, to be able to do it, It's just you know, it's possible that you need incredibly narrow slits and so forth, but
theoretically it would work.
There's no fundamental distinction between how physical bodies as a quantum mechanical object and a single electron. So we think quantum mechanics is universal, applies everywhere. So Michael,
Two questions. Continuing on with that, okay, let's assume we could observe the quantum mechanics of microscopic objects. Now the energy of the photon that we're using to observe the person is relatively very small, and the observation is much less violent. Is it possible then that act of observing it doesn't disturb the experiment in the same way it does disturb the experiment with the electrons?
It's possible. You have to actually look at the details. So the general rule is, if you interact with an electron or any object, and in principle you could get some information about, you could get some information about which path it went, then that's enough to destroy the interference pattern, even if you don't actually do the calculations and find out the information.
So the next question I have, if we use the double slit with the electrons, and let's say we were to bombard it with a fairly heavy stream of photons that was coming through the slits, however, not record the data, not observe the data, not look at the data, but still disrupt the interference pattern.
So yeah, it would because the record is still there.
It's not the knowledge that we gain, but it's the actual interaction with the photon that disturbs them.
So yeah, that's what it seems to be. The record would still be there on the computer. So it's not something to do with consciousness that does it. Right. Still, there's this macroscopic record that you could one day look at, and if you did actually look at that, you would find out. So it's just having potential knowledge.
So even if you destroy the record, it's not...
If you destroy that, then sometimes you can actually regain the interference pattern. So, yeah. And so they've actually done, that's called quantum erasure, and they've done experiments on that. And they've actually, in a sense, recorded which slit the electron went through, and then kind of erased the recording, and then you get the interference pattern back.
Cut back into, so they recorded, they saw this interference pattern, then they destroyed the recording, and suddenly the fringes came back. Is that what you're saying?
No. once you make the records, you get one pattern or another pattern. That's done. Yeah. But before you've made the final measurement, you could do this experiment, and if in principle, so you could do this experiment and the electrons are just here, say they're actually, you could make the distance between here and any, let's make it a really large distance. Let's make it 10 kilometers between the front wall and the rear wall. So it's this huge distance. What you can do is you can have these two cameras here, they can record which slit each electron goes through, and you do this with thousands of electrons. And then you can set it up so that the electrons, then they move off here, and they're almost here, so they're 9.9 kilometers away to actually being towards the final wall. So they're well and truly past the cameras. And if you didn't do anything else, you would actually see just this pattern here, because you found out which path the electron went through. So you know you've got particle-like behavior, so you're not going to see the wave-like behavior. That you want to see the interference fringes, then in principle you have to do this in just the right way, but you can actually erase the information from there to cameras, and then you can get the interference pattern back, and that's called quantum erasure. And they've done experiments with this, but not with cameras, but at the level of single photons.
Right.
So that's very weird, because hang on, the electrons are passed here, so everything's done. So how does that happen? But quantum physics says that you can. Why? I don't know.
Doesn't that sort of relate to that? Because there's an idea that we could create, isn't there a branch of quantum physics that says we could create our own reality? And the process of observing it alters that reality?
So that sounds like it's, I'm not exactly what showing
you. It's metaphysical, like it's the metaphysical side of it where it's, by the act of observing our world, we change our world. So that's
sure. I don't know if I'd go so far as us observing the world creates reality, because it's not like if we have a free choice, I can just dream up whatever I want to, and I can create that reality. I don't know. I think you've got to be careful in just how far you take that. But some physicists have said some things kind of along those lines, but I think some people, and I think in my view, extrapolate them too far and get kind of too new agey and so forth. But something like that, in a restricted way, can be a useful way of thinking about things. That the way Neil Paul talked about it was, you have a voluntary choice whether to put the cameras in here or not. And depending on which of the two experiments you do, with some cameras or without some cameras, you will, in a sense, be able to force the electrons to manifest their wave-like or particle-like nature. So in that sense, perhaps. Yes?
The interaction between the photon and the electron, is that another example of entanglement, where near the slit they interact, and then when you change something about the photon, that caused the interaction, then 9 kilometers away, it's the electron that also then sees that change in the interaction with the photon.
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty much any interaction that you have can cause entanglement. So you actually, you will get entanglement there. So, definitely. Yes, up the back.
My question was back to the four fundamental forces.
Right.
We know that the photon is the carrier of the electromagnetic force, but have we looked at something like the gravitational force or the weak or strong nuclear force as a way of measuring the electron going through? Therefore, it's not going to cause the same kind of interaction, because all of these you talked about are talking about electromagnetic force. So it's going to have an impact.
No one has. So the strong and weak nuclear forces, they're very, very short-range forces. So technically it would be very difficult to work with them. And generally gravity, at the scale of a single electron, gravity is phenomenally weak. So it's all been electromagnetic. That kind of dominates these experiments. So no it hasn't. So, that would be an interesting thing to do, it hasn't. But the theory is it would be exactly the same. So it would be very, very strange if we saw completely different stuff.
Do you think
according to quantum mechanics, it's exactly the same. That you could, in principle, build a gravitational detector, and that it would actually get the same results if you had some weird gravity detector instead of the cameras, or some weird strong force detector instead of the cameras. So quantum physics predicts you'd see exactly the same, in theory, the same results as what you do get with some detector based on the electromagnetic force. But no one has actually done the experiment. Actually, might take just one last question. One last question, and then we'll move on. Yes?
If you only had one camera, would you not detect three and quantum waves at the same time? Because you would have the waves going through one slit and the quantum waves.
No, I think you detect particles, because if you know when the electrons are coming through, if you detect one here, then it's a particle, so you see the particle behavior. But if you know you don't detect one here, then you know it must have gone through the other slit by thus kind of a process of elimination. So if you know when the electrons are going through, what time, you can just wave at that particular time. And if your detector doesn't register, or if it does, then you know it went through this slit. But if it doesn't register, then if it didn't go through this slit, then it had to go through that slit. So I think you would still get particle in that case.
Very related question.
Yeah.
Is there anything in the theory that would prevent us from being able to see it as both a particle and a wave at the same time? Is it technically feasible, or is there something in theory that says no, either you see it as a particle or as a wave? Is there any way of detecting it at the same time?
Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So, which we're getting onto now.
Okay.
But absolutely, there is the fundamental. So, okay, so we'll go another five just to the end of this slide. So, well, we have somehow the act of measuring particle-like behavior, which slit went through, actually destroyed the interference pattern. And this is, as we'll see a little bit later, this is related to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And what we do find is, when we actually do that, if we do the modified experiment, what we find is the probability of the electron going through one slit the probability of the electron going, hitting at some particular point A or X is actually just the sum of the two probabilities. So the probability rule has actually changed, that the probability when both slits are open of finding the electron hitting at one point, X is just the sum of the probability of finding it hitting at that particular point when we've got just slit one open, we have slit two closed, plus the probability of finding the electron hitting when we have slit one open, closed and slit two open. So that now we can actually, because we've changed the experiment, we can actually use this intuitive rule. We do the double slit, do the experiment with one slit open, we find 100 electrons there, do the experiment with the other slit open, find 200 electrons at the same point, then we can just overlay the two experiments in the other, and when you have both slits open, we do find we have 300 electrons fitting in that particular region. And mathematically, it's given by this expression here. And so, just very quickly, as an aside, this is sort of a general rule when there are two or more ways that something can happen in quantum physics, and those ways are actually distinguishable, there's some way to tell where which slit the electron went through, then the rule for adding, finding the probabilities changes. We don't add the amplitudes and then find out the total amplitude, then find out the total probability. What we do is we just add the probabilities together in some sort of, which is a more of a common sense way, because if I had 10, just 100, if I had 100 toonies all lined up here, and I tossed 50 of them, and I got heads, so if I tossed 50 of them, then the probability, then most likely I get, say, 25 heads out of the 50 I tossed. If I tossed the other 50, most likely I'd get around about 25 heads as well. And so to figure out what I would get most likely, where if I tossed all 100 of them together, then we just add up the two possibilities of 25 plus 25 to give us 50 for what I'd most likely get if I did tossing 100 toonies. And so just as you kind of add those two together, so if you have events you can distinguish between quantum physics, you just add the two together. And this is an example. So what we will do now is we will have coffee break. And when we come back, we'll all be back exactly on the dot, because, and the carrot is, we have actually a video of Richard Feynman speaking. And I'll need everyone here back on time for that. So, quarter two.
Quarter two.
Nice job.